Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Jill Robbins, and Susan Shand. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Facebook says it has successfully tested a computer program that can help keep users from taking their own lives. The social media network now says it will expand the use of the pattern recognition software to other countries. Facebook began testing the software in the United States in March. The software is considered an example of artificial intelligence. In February, Facebook chief Mark Zuckerberg wrote in a statement that artificial intelligence could be used to help keep people safe. The software scans messages on Facebook for comments that could be signs that a person intends to harm themselves. Facebook has not released any of the technical details about the program. But the company did say that it looks for phrases such as, "Are you okay?" and "Can I help?" If the software finds the signs it is looking for, it alerts a team of Facebook workers who specialize in dealing with such reports. The system suggests resources to the user or to friends of the person, such as a telephone helpline. Facebook workers sometimes call local officials to take action. Facebook said it tries to have specialists available at any hour to call officials in local languages. Guy Rosen is Facebook's vice president for product management. He posted a description of the program on the Facebook website on Monday. He said the company was expanding use of the software because the tests were successful. He said first responders checked on people more than 100 times after Facebook's software raised alarms. Reuters reported that Rosen said, "Speed really matters. We have to get help in real time." Facebook started to use the new software after the launch of live video broadcasting in 2016. A number of incidents took place in which people were live broadcasting violent acts, including suicides and murders. In May, the company said it would hire 3,000 people to monitor video and other content. Rosen did not say where Facebook would use the software outside the U.S. He said, in time, it would be used around the world, except in the European Union, where privacy laws would likely place limits on its use. Google is another technology company that tries to prevent suicides by monitoring users. The Google search engine will show a hotline telephone number if certain searches are made. Facebook uses information from its users to target advertising. The company has not announced in the past that it scans messages for harmful behavior. However, the company says it does look for suspicious comments between children and adult sex criminals. Facebook says sometimes it contacts officials when it finds targeted discussions. Ryan Callow is a law professor at the University of Washington. He says scanning people's discussions is harder to justify in other situations. Callow said, "Once you open the door, you might wonder what other kinds of things we would be looking for." Rosen declined to comment about whether Facebook is considering pattern recognition software to fight non-sex-related crimes. The company announced that it was using technology and other resources to help save lives on September 7th, World Suicide Prevention Day. I'm Mario Ritter.
For students at the Farm School in Hamilton, Virginia, the classroom is outside every day. Jacqueline Jenkins is a founder of the school.
The number one question immediately we get from parents is, what happens when it rains? And we say, bring an extra pair of clothes.
Jenkins adds that we still educate them. They also get energy. Their brains are working when they're moving. So our goal is to always be outside. The Farm School is a preschool, a place for 3- and 4-year-olds to learn and play. Teacher Allison Huff has taught at other schools. She says the Farm School gives its students more of a hands-on learning experience. For example, children use pumpkins to learn about colors and counting. They learn about measurements by planting seeds 30 centimeters apart. In addition to planting vegetables and fruits, youngsters help prepare food and clean up afterward. The school teaches the children to cook using the food they have grown. The preschoolers also learn words in languages other than English. Huff speaks in both English and Spanish. Her assistant speaks French and Arabic. She adds that a 3-year-old in her class speaks 4 different languages. Farm animals are also an important part of the education program. Jacqueline Jenkins says the youngsters learn about a different animal every month. The idea for a school like this started after Jenkins and her husband Kenny bought a farm in Hamilton with a late 18th century house on the property. They called it One Day Farm because years earlier they had hoped that one day they would have a farm. Family and friends started to visit, to learn about farming and to see the animals. The Jenkins believe children need a school like the Farm School instead of learning from electronic devices. Courtney Williams liked the idea, so she asked the school to admit her 3-year-old son, Ken, as a student.
For me, it's the best of both worlds. He is learning to count his colors, all the things to keep him, you know, competitive in this education competition. But he gets to be a kid. He gets to jump in puddles and he gets to try to climb trees and run and roll down hills. And he is able to get to experience the things that because I work and because my husband works that we're not able to give him at home.
The children come home with new experiences, new knowledge, and sometimes a few vegetables. The Farm School wants to teach the entire family and bring the natural world back into the classroom. I'm Susan Shand.
Scientists are using robotic devices to study the health of waters in and around Venice, Italy. The robots are designed to act like fish, other underwater creatures, and plants. The scientists are working with several universities and research centers as part of a group called Subcultron. The European Union gives money to the project as part of its Horizon 2020 program. The aim of Horizon 2020 is to take great ideas from the lab to the market and support world-class science and innovation in Europe. Francesco Barbario is with the Institute for Marine Sciences in Venice. He says the goal is to use the artificial intelligence of the robots to help humans understand what is happening under the water of the Venice Lagoon. Subcultron is a collective artificial intelligence project whose aim is to create the biggest shoal of robot fish in the world. The aim of the project is to improve knowledge of the seabed and, from a technological point of view, to try to transfer human abilities to high-tech items. As part of the project, the scientists created three kinds of robots: the A-mussel, the A-fish, and the A-pad. An A-mussel sits on the bottom of the sea and gathers information about the plants, bacteria, and animals around it. It also collects information from the other robots and helps them communicate with each other. An A-pad floats on top of the water like a lily pad. It communicates with people about the ships on the water and gets information from satellites orbiting the Earth. The A-fish moves around between the A-pads and A-mussels. It explores the water and shares information with the A-mussels and A-pads. Together, the robots form a swarm, like a group of bees going about their jobs, or birds moving together as one in the sky. As the robots work together, they appear to be learning to organize themselves in the same way living things do. Alexandre Campo is a computer scientist at the Université Libre de Bruxelles. He says the scientists looked at the way animals learn to work in groups to understand how robots can learn to work together. The Subcultron project wants its robots to learn to work together so they can watch for changes and new problems in the water. One problem the researchers had in the beginning was how the robots would communicate with each other. Wi-Fi and GPS equipment do not work underwater. Instead, the robots can use sonar and an electric field. Thomas Schmickel is a biologist at the University of Graz in Austria. He says the robots cannot see in the water because it is not clear. So they act like some fish in South America and Africa. The electric field the robots send out lets them sense what is near them and react to it. Another problem was charging batteries. The robots come up to the water's surface and can charge by staying near a boat or a power station to charge without any electric cables. The water is not clear, but it is getting better. Fabrizio Bernardi Aubry is with the Institute for Marine Sciences. He says, the health status of the lagoon is pretty good. There are no industrial polluters, and the city now has a modern sewer system. It's not like before, when all the sewers flushed directly in the water. Other projects in Europe use robots to watch water quality. The robots in Venice will continue their work until 2019. The Subcultron project hopes they develop into an artificial society underneath the water surface that serves a human society above the water. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of a document that defined a nation, the United States Constitution. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain in 1776. But they had to fight for that independence in a long war that followed. During that war, the states were united by an agreement called the Articles of Confederation. But the Union of 13 states was loosely organized. The Articles of Confederation created a weak central government. The document did not create courts or provide for a president or other executive to carry out laws. The Articles of Confederation did create a Congress, but that legislature had little power or money. When British General Charles Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, a messenger brought the news to the Congress. But Congress could not even pay the messenger, so money had to be collected from each member. The war ended in 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. Even before then, three influential Americans had called for a change in this loose confederation of states. The three were George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. They urged the formation of a strong central government. George Washington commanded America's troops during the Revolution. He opposed the Articles of Confederation because they provided little support for his army. His soldiers struggled with shortages of food, warm clothing, shoes, and other supplies. Here is an actor playing George Washington in a show at the National Archives. He is talking about the Articles of Confederation.
In my mind, it prolonged the war by several years. Every time I needed men or money to prosecute the war, I had to go to 13 sovereign heads of state hat in hand. Even now, under peacetime conditions, we are like a giant with 13 heads tottering towards a cliff.
Alexander Hamilton was a young lawyer who served as an aide to General Washington during the Revolution. Hamilton called for a convention of the 13 states to create a new central government. He expressed his opinion in letters, speeches, and newspaper articles. Finally, there was James Madison. He was one of the authors of the state constitution in Virginia in 1776. When Madison, Hamilton, and Washington looked at the Articles of Confederation, they saw an unhappy picture. There were 13 governments that each tried to help themselves at the expense of the others. Each state had its own army. Nine states had their own navy. The states had these forces to protect themselves from each other. For example, Virginia passed a law which said it could seize ships that did not pay taxes to the state. Virginia did not mean ships from Great Britain or Spain. It meant ships from other states, like Maryland and Pennsylvania.
Basically, the thought was, we need a military defense structure, we need a modest army and a navy, we need to regulate trade with Europe, and individual states in a loose confederation won't do the job.
Akhil Reed Amar is a professor at Yale Law School. He says Americans realized a strong central government could improve their national security system. In 1786, representatives from Maryland and Virginia met to discuss opening land for new settlements along the Potomac River. The Potomac formed the border between those two states. The representatives agreed that the issue of settling new land was too big for just two states to decide. Someone asked, why not invite Delaware and Pennsylvania to help? Someone else said all the states should be invited. Then they could discuss all the problems that were giving the new nation so much trouble. The idea was accepted, and a convention was set for Annapolis, Maryland. The convention opened as planned, but it was not much of a meeting. Representatives came from only five states. The men who did meet at Annapolis, however, agreed that it was a beginning. They agreed, too, that a larger convention should be called. They appointed the representative from New York, Alexander Hamilton, to put the agreement in writing. So Hamilton sent a message to the legislature of each state. He called for a convention in Philadelphia in May of the next year, 1787. The purpose of the convention, he said, would be to write a constitution for the United States. The nation was new, but the idea of a constitution was not. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar explains that the earliest settlers had formed political agreements called compacts, charters, or corporations. These agreements developed into state constitutions.
And then, in 1787-88, the idea becomes to try to continentalize, to take on a much bigger scale this idea of a written constitution setting forth the rules for how people would govern themselves, what government could do and not do, what their powers would be, and what the limits would be.
Even so, he says, Americans were not sure about creating such a constitution. Amar says they were afraid a new central government might be as arrogant and out of touch as the King of England had been. However, most people slowly came to believe that a strong central government would protect their country better than the loose union of 13 states could. Many people also believed that a constitutional convention would not succeed without George Washington. People wanted to elect him president of the convention, but Washington did not want to go. He suffered from rheumatism. His mother and sister were sick. He needed to take care of business at Mount Vernon, his farm in Virginia. And he already said he was not interested in public office. George Washington was the most famous man in America. Suppose only a few states sent representatives to the convention. Suppose it failed. Would he look foolish? Two close friends, James Madison and Edmund Randolph, urged George Washington to go to Philadelphia. He trusted them, so he said he would go as one of the representatives of Virginia. From that moment, it was clear the convention would be an important event. If George Washington would be there, it had to be important. The first delegate to arrive in Philadelphia for the convention was James Madison. Madison was 35 years old. He was short and losing his hair. He was not a good speaker, but he always knew what he wanted to say. He had read everything that had been published in English about governments, from the governments of ancient Greece to those of his own time. Madison believed the United States needed a strong central government that was more powerful than the 13 states. Madison also knew that he should not push his ideas too quickly, so he planned his work quietly. He came to the convention with hundreds of books and papers. He was prepared to answer any question about government that any other representative might ask him. Madison asked the other delegates from Virginia to also arrive early. He wanted to enter the convention with a plan for a strong central government. He was sure no other state would do this. Two Virginia delegates came early as requested. Together, the three men worked on Madison's plan. The only other delegates there were from Pennsylvania. Nobody seemed worried that there were no delegates from the other 11 states. After all, it took 2 weeks to ride a horse to Philadelphia from New Hampshire in the Northeast, and it took as long as 3 weeks to get to Philadelphia from Georgia in the South. Finally, the other delegates started coming, a few at a time. 55 men in all from 12 states. Pennsylvania sent the most delegates, 8. Rhode Island sent none. A few of the delegates were very old, but many were in their 20s or 30s. The average age of the delegates was just 43 years. From the moment the convention began, Madison kept careful records of everything everyone said. He never stopped writing. If it were not for James Madison, we would know little of what happened at that historic meeting in Philadelphia in 1787. Later, Madison explained how he did it. He wrote, "I sat in front of the president of the convention. All the other delegates were on my right and on my left. I could hear everything the president said. I could hear all the words of every delegate. I made notes only I could understand. Then, at night in my room, I wrote out completely all the speeches and acts. I attended the convention every day. I was there as long as the delegates were meeting and talking." James Madison's full records of the convention were not published until 30 years later.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.